Welcome to Waking Up in America with Valerie Kirkgaard. All comments, views, and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of Valerie, her guests, and callers. Now here's your host, Valerie Kirkgaard.
Hey, we are here, and you're listening to Waking Up in America, dynamic radio dialogues on vital issues. It's our 21st year in radio, and we're inviting angels and sponsors to bring us into your neighborhood. Any ideas? Want to get a hold of a guest or staff? Call our new toll-free number at 866-604-9966. That's 866-604-9966. During the show, you can actually send me an email at val@wakinguminamerica.com. And if we have time or if you've got a really great question, we'll actually read it on the air. So to get things started off, let's remember something that our forefathers set up for us. And republics are a good thing. So I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. That's our origin, folks. And I really appreciate the election that we just had, where the largest amount of people voted in an election, depending upon who you talk to, in 90 to 100 years. So that's our citizens in action. I'm Dr. Val Kirkgaard, and in 1984, I carried the Olympic torch. And once that torch is ignited, you can just really never put it down. And today, I invite you to light your torch and join the standards held forth by all bearers of this 2,000-year-old flame, which is Citius Altius Fortius, swifter, higher, stronger. Our guests reflect these values and come from all fields, from internationally known nutritionist J.J. Virgin to Taekwondo champion Mary Louise Zeller to the very solar Mr. Larry Hagman. Bob Sercosto of the Home Shopping Network says, "We're doing radio which will change the world." Help us make that true by letting your friends know about us and visiting our site and sign up with our newsletter, which gives information on our sponsors and lets you know the up-and-coming guests. If you happen to hear a telephone ringing, a dog barking, or an angel singing, know that we call in from our homes and offices all over the United States to cause this program, actually even foreign calls sometimes. So I normally start out the show with my little rant on a particular subject, but actually what I'm thinking about today is the possibility of the parables. Our guest, John Neumeyer, actually met him at a very cool birthday party this year. Turned out a very interesting man who likes the same kind of champagne I do. John was educated at Caltech and Harvard, and for 36 years he's actually worked as an epidemiologist at the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic in San Francisco, examining substance abuse and related ideas. That's what it says on his book jacket, but John's a lot more deep and fun than all of that. There are people that consider him one of the most creative minds around, absolutely is. You want to pick up his book, Mother of All Gateway Drugs, Parables for Our Time, and you can get that at johnneumeyer.com. And Neumeyer is spelled N-E-W-M-E-Y-E-R. He's a Ph.D., and he's a Ph.D. of creativity, as far as I'm concerned. I was just asking him before the show about whether there were truth in his parables or not. And you'll get some very good ideas when you read John's book. But one of the things that we're going to just start off with is, John, give our listening audience a background on, you know, what you've been up to and how you got into it. What drew you into this in the first place?
Well, substance use is not at all a narrow field. It encompasses a lot of what we eat and drink. Sugar in our diet, our love of wine and coffee, these are all psychoactive drugs that change our mood, change our approach to the day. So it's a very large part of our lives. I would say one of the 9 or 10 key questions of human life is, what substances do we use to change our state of mind?
Well, you know, one of the things that I'm thinking here is that maybe people think that John disapproves of all of these things, but part of your background also includes, how many years have you been a vintner?
I've grown grapes and made wine for 24 years, so if you can't lick them, join them, I would say.
But you're not speaking from a place of disapproval. You're speaking from a place of a creative approach and also recognition that human beings need relaxation and pick-me-ups.
Yes, we need three different things, basically. A pick-me-up simulation for our coffee or tobacco or illegally are cocaine and speed. Then we need relief from pain, attitude adjustment. That's our cocktail in the evening, or our heroin if we go to the illegal side. And finally, we need just sheer pleasure, a gladdening of spirit. And that sugar dessert picks you up in that way, gladdens you, or marijuana on the somewhat illegal side.
What about sex?
What's that?
What about sex?
Well, they say endorphins come and affect the brain in a way that certain drugs do. I'm not going to go there because sex is so much part of a much larger context of human interaction and love. I'll just stick with the substances.
No, it's interesting because when you and I were talking before the show, I was telling you that I work for the Gay and Lesbian Community Services Center in Hollywood as part of my my training. You have to do actually 3,000 hours to get your MFCC.
And wow, that's several years, yeah.
Oh, yes, and I picked different places. So I do internships in different places. I really appreciated working in Hollywood because I was exposed to so much. And in the addictions, which, we're not going to talk that much about today as far as sexuality is concerned, but one of the things we dealt with was sexual compulsives.
Mm.
And at that time, when I was working there, it was actually the beginning of the HIV conversation. So you and I were touching on that, and you've had a lot of that's transmitted in community, right?
Yes. Yeah, so of course, we have to say that with substances, there is a negative, a downside. That just as you have sexual compulsion, there are compulsion to use various drugs, particularly the ones that are more powerful and have an effect on the endorphins and begin to substitute the body's natural pleasures giving with an artificial source. So there is a source of a possibility of abuse for all these substances.
Well, you know, what I understand that one of the big things now is crystal meth.
That's the nastiest of all. If any drug needs to have strict resistance erected against it, it's that drug. I call it speed exceptionalism.
And isn't it actually like some kind of like paint thinner or something like that?
Not exactly. It's as nasty. Of course, it's very far removed from anything organic or natural. Heroin is derived from the opium poppy. Cocaine from the coca leaf. Marijuana, of course, is marijuana leaf. But speed is strictly from the laboratory.
So one of the things that I know, I'm a big person on Monavi, and I love what Monavi does for the body. It gives me certain things that other things that are generated chemically can't give me. And one of the things that I know, John, is that things that are natural don't steal from your body as much as things that are chemical.
Exactly.
So...
And the other thing about things that are natural is that you can grow them yourself, and you can have them in very dilute, manageable forms, coca tea rather than cocaine. Tobacco with filtered tobacco rather than Gauloise.
I'm sorry, what was the last thing you said?
Filtered tobacco instead of smoking a powerful cigarette like a Gauloise or a Lucky Strike.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah,
I thought those were the coolest. Those are the ones with the moons on them, quarter moons on them.
Yeah.
I used to like leaving those in ashtrays.
Oh, yeah.
Now I got off smoking, actually, was by using Darjeems.
Uh-huh.
Do you know that one?
Are those clove cigarettes?
The clove cigarettes.
Yeah.
That's how I was able to stop smoking. They're so strong.
Strong, but no nicotine, which is addictive. Yeah.
So that was how I got off it. But it's like so interesting because as I realized that we were going to have this interview and I realized the intertwining of the sociality of drugs and the chemicalness of drugs and the naturalness of drugs and all these things, there are just so many lines that are blurred.
They are, and so much a part of everyday life. And the sociality is, as you say, the using the substance with other people after dinner, the cup of coffee, perhaps the brandy, even the cigarette. In that context, there's a kind of control, as if we're saying, well, this is to be used as a special thing with friends or after dinner in a kind of social or at least a temporal context.
Well, I was thinking perhaps we could take a walk through things that we call drugs and talk about their damages, perhaps, and also their goodnesses.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking in terms of crystal meth, why do people use that? What do they get out of it that makes them initially get hooked on it?
It's a very powerful stimulant. It's also long-lasting, lasts hours, as opposed to the minutes you might experience with crack cocaine.
So are they feeling euphoric, or what are they feeling?
It's not so much euphoric as potent, all-powerful, omnipotent.
Oh, okay, that's good. I can see why people would need that.
And in a sense, if you know Milton's Paradise Lost, the user is kind of a Satan figure. Satan, the beautiful angel who has such pride that he stands up to God. That's this experience with crystal meth, this sense of tremendous self-value. Actually, you're a jerk, but you sense yourself as a kind of a beautiful angel.
No, somewhere I got sent an email on it, John, and I just cried when I saw it. It was a woman that had been on crystal meth for 2 years, and she looked like she was about 90 years old. Her teeth were gone.
Yeah.
I don't know what it does to the teeth, but it robs something. And she was just begging to die.
Recovery is possible, even there.
What are the odds of getting off this stuff?
The odds? Well, they're pretty good, because most people do seem to get through crystal meth and survive, although with much damages. It's far, far more damaging than heroin or alcohol.
That's what I was going to ask, because I don't know. Well, we were talking about the 70s earlier, and I know one of the things in Time magazine, I remember seeing back in the 70s, early 80s at the latest, I saw they were always demonstrating the horrible death of the heroin user.
Yes, although that's less directly connected with the drug than with the diseases which are connected with it. Using impure substances, embolism.
Would you tell our listener what an embolism is?
Embolism is like a little air. Could be an air clot that gets into your veins, gets to your heart, and can block key functioning and cause cardiac arrest or death.
Wow. Listen, we're on the air with John Neumeyer, Parables for Our Times, mother of all gateway drugs. I tell you, check this guy out at johnneumeyer.com, and that's N-E-W.
Actually, jneumeyer@aol.com.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Oh, that actually is your mailing ad, your email address, isn't it? I thought
email.
I was giving your website address.
Website is neumeyer.com.
Oh, there
so,
you go. Thank you.
Either way.
So we're on the air with this guy, and we're coming back, and I've got to just say thank you to a few people that make this show possible. I want to thank the good guys here, Stardoves. Want to advertise something really inexpensively over the Internet to 200,000 really interested people? You give Raw at Stardoves a telephone call and tell them Val sent you, and you will be blown away at how inexpensive it is to reach 200,000 people. Call 828-665-0411. And if you leave a message at 310-459-4824, I can even give you the name of a really good web person that works really inexpensively. So a lot of people who have actually been on Waking Up in America have taken me up on these people and are very happy. Also, if you just need a rest after what we've been going through with the election, hop down to San Concho, Mexico, which is 45 minutes north of Puerto Vallarta, and visit Steve and Diana at Roberto's Bungalows, a short walk to the beach, cozy little rooms with kitchens, pool, and great service, and you have nothing to worry about in San Concho. It's the borders that are a pain, but not this part of the town. This is a wonderful place to live, and you will remember having visited San Concho for all of your life. I love the place, and very happy to be there. So we're back with John Neumeyer here. And John, so we've been talking about crystal meth. Let's say that I started taking heroin when I was a kid, and I had access to it, and there was nothing wrong with it in my culture. Would I be in any kind of good health, or would I be wrecked?
The physical health wouldn't be too bad. It's less debilitating than using alcohol for decades.
Really?
It's the kind of psychological, you can think of the opium smokers of China and India. Their lives weren't foreshortened so much as their careers were impeded.
Because they didn't care or what?
Yeah, you don't care. It's an attitude adjustment drug, just like the cocktail in the afternoon. It's something you take after work because you're inclination to get anything done is diffuses in an opiate fog of a dreamy, pleasant fog.
Do you have control? Well, for instance, like I said, here I am. I'm a person. I started using heroin when I was 17, say, or 18.
Right.
You know, joined my friends who was using it. I go to work in the daytime. Is this possible, what I'm saying? I go to work in the daytime, I work, and then I come home and kick up my heels. And you smoke it, or what do you do with it?
I think your boss might notice the lack of productivity
So I couldn't manage it. I mean, I couldn't, like, work and then hop into my heroin in the evening.
That would be better, yes. Take it in the evening.
Well, that's what I was saying. I'm just trying to put these things in perspective. Because we get given such horror stories, you know?
But the horror story with heroin is when you stop using it. You have to keep at it because you're essentially telling your body to shut down the production of endorphins, the natural painkiller, and take the heroin as a substitute, the artificial. So it's when you try to stop, when your supply has cut off, then it takes a long time and a very painful time to get back to your own natural.
What's actually causing, I remember seeing, what was the movie that Frank Sinatra was in? Man with a Golden Arm.
Yeah.
That was, oh my God. And then that was intense. What was causing him all that pain?
The withdrawal.
What is it about the withdrawal that is so incredibly painful?
The withdrawal is what your body naturally does. The endorphins that cause your body to deal with pain, to not feel pain. They're naturally produced. And what heroin does is says, okay, I've got something even better that's very similar. You can shut down now, body. And so the body shuts down its natural endorphins and relies on this artificial, this substance, the opiate, to provide the pain reduction. The pain reduction is greater, but heaven help you, if you stop using it, if your supply is cut off, then you have neither your body's natural endorphins nor the artificial supply to deal with pain. So the pain is very great. It's the withdrawal. It's the nightmare of withdrawal.
And how long does that normally take for a person to go through that process?
Days, and not only that, you have the craving for the drug because you kind of subconsciously know that if I would just have a shot of heroin, I'm going to feel so much more comfortable, so much less in pain. Not just physical pain, but psychological, emotional pain. That you might be going through. Heroin is very effective against all of these.
So are there any people that have continued using heroin on a regular basis that would be considered healthy citizens?
Oh, yeah. We see it at the clinic. We call them VSOPs, a very special old product. The old junkies, some have gone on for 30, 35 years. I saw them in the 70s, and they still come.
Are they all on the streets?
Some of them are just in ordinary life. As I say, their productivity is not likely to be very great unless they really control by just using it after work. It does impede productivity and motivation. But other than that, and other than all the side problems like impure needles, HIV transmission, any kind of use of an impure product.
Would you let our audience know how serious a problem this is?
How serious?
Yeah.
Actually, it's declining in California. There's less of a problem with heroin. We've seen ups and downs, but this is one of the periods when we're, at least in California, seeing a good decline. Of course, locally, here and there, people are getting into heroin and having quite a nasty time with it.
Is there another favorite drug that's taking place, or is there just a decrease in drugs?
Big thing that's going up, everything else seems to be going down, at least in the San Francisco Bay Area. We've seen remarkable declines in everything, but the prescription painkillers, I'm talking OxyContin, hydrocodone, Vicodin, things of that sort.
And I think I had a Vicodin once, and I remember when I had my hip surgery, it's interesting, my doctor's name that administers the anesthesia was actually Dr. Frankenstein. I found that very funny. But he made me a really good cocktail. And
it's very effective, yeah. It's a good substitute for heroin because it deals with the pain. But you get the prescription. It says, not renewable. You have 30 pills to deal with after you've had your surgery. Take it twice a day to deal with pain. And then what happens is you get the 30 pills, and after maybe 5 or 10 or 15 pills, the pain goes away, you're healed. And then you leave it in your medicine chest, and your spouse or your kid finds it. There's the problem.
Mm.
There's the problem. So that's why we have an increasing problem. It's prescribed so promiscuously, and only now is the medical profession realizing, uh-oh, this has got to be pull back the throttle on this one.
How are they managing this?
Well, I think the managing is every physician, and this is not a Schedule One or Schedule Two. It's a drug that's fairly easy to be prescribed to get from your physician. The management comes in more careful warning or discouraging of the public and the use of this drug. Like, if you get a Vicodin supply, be sure either to throw away the pills or lock them up so that someone who's not who hasn't been prescribed the drug gets his or her hands on it.
I remember being in the 70s, and I was losing weight, and I went to the doctor, and the doctor gave me some diet pills, and I was going to a dinner that night, and I wanted to fit in this dress. And so I took the diet pills in the daytime.
Uh-huh.
I hadn't taken them before. I had taken like 2 diet pills, and then I hadn't eaten much, and then this was so brilliant of me. I then had a couple of scotches, like only 2.
Uh-oh, yeah.
But only, you know, I mean, it's
yeah.
not enough that you would think all by yourself that this is a bad thing. But at that time, there were no drug warnings. So
uh-huh.
I took 2 scotches, and I woke up the next day. No, well, I actually went in the bedroom to change my son's diapers.
Uh-huh.
And I remember calling my husband because I was falling to the floor.
Oh.
The next day, and that's the last thing I remember was holding John in my arms and protecting him and falling towards the floor. And the next day, I was wearing my clothes. My husband was looking at me with strange eyes when I woke up. And it turned out I had been, I don't know what made me do this, but maybe you could say, I ended up like running all over the house screaming and stuff like that. What could have caused something like that?
That's pretty unusual. I would expect more of a hangover experience.
It wasn't a hangover at all. It was like that I had this very unusual behavior.
Well, this, of course, you took a diet pill, which is probably Dexedrine, so maybe it was still acting.
Huh.
Maybe you had a glass of water, and it kind of potentiated the drug in your system.
It took me. I've never taken a diet pill since, you can imagine, and I don't take much in the way of any other pill for pretty much the same reason. That was such a learner for me. But, you know, how many of us are in situations where we're really not taking what we're taking seriously enough?
A lot. And that's why the 4 words, legalize, tax, regulate, discourage, should be our drug policy for the next generation. The last part, discourage, means, well, educate. Discourage the overuse of any of these substances, any, even sugar or marijuana, which are perhaps the least harmful. Because...
So say what you just said about sugar and marijuana, because I think it's actually absurd that there's something like 1 million hours of people in jail for marijuana possession.
Something like that, a million, yeah, a great number of people for marijuana possession. But marijuana is like sugar in its basic effect. You feel happy. You feel it's a gladdening. It's you know, any kid at the age of 1. Discover sugar. Ah, what a wonderful substance. I feel terrific. I feel so happy. Marijuana, the same thing. Both drugs, but maybe especially sugar, the problem is when you have too much of it, when it becomes not just for dessert, not just an occasion, but when it's in the very drink which you quench your thirst. No, sugar doesn't belong in drink. Sugar belongs in dessert, in a kind of controlled...
Oh, I see what you're saying. So these are part of the distinctions that I was thinking about. Actually,
yeah.
We're going to be taking a break right now, and then we'll
okay.
be back. It's time for Diamond Alignment.
We live in a world that is more alive with possibility than ever before in history. Yet it is easy to get lost in the confusion and chaos of such an accelerated world. How do we stay connected and aligned with the unlimited potential that lies within us and soar in these exciting yet challenging times. Diamond Alignment, a sacred technology for the 21st century, offers high-speed connection and alignment with this divine power within, both convenient and profound. The 6-minute multi-sensory diamond experience delivered via the internet clears your mind, relaxes your body, and creates inner peace no matter what is going on around you. The Diamond Alignment experience effortlessly keeps you charged with joy and equanimity and greater focus and clarity throughout your day. When you experience the expansive energy of Diamond Alignment, you activate the unlimited wealth and potential within you.
Funny, when I talked to Jacqueline about this, and I said, what exactly is that sound? She said, Val, these are divine transmissions. And I liked it because I don't know about you, John, but it makes my molecules do something nice to each other. When I hear this, I can feel my field shifts or something of that nature.
Yeah, it's pleasing. It's pleasing. I could listen to that kind of music for hours.
Yeah. So you can actually go to our website and you can click on the Diamond Alignment and you can hear this sound, and you can also sign up for it on a monthly basis. And I just totally, it's a good thing. A lot of times I'll just go click it on and then I'll work while this sound is playing on the computer. And it's really funny. When I had very volatile people on the show, John, you could actually hear a shift between the first part of the show and the second part of the show after we played this little 2-minute piece.
Yes.
And you can hear it, and it's really funny. There's a very famous man who didn't hear it and was quite funny about it. But it was like I said, how did you like, I didn't hear it, it didn't do anything, so I won't mention his name, but I said more about him than about Diamond Alignment.
Exactly.
So we're reachable in many ways, and one of them is Jacqueline's Divine Transmissions. Another is John's book. I tell you, you're gonna chuckle. You said when you sent me the book about how it was a serious book, I actually found it a very entertaining book and a very interesting book. One of the things you brought up, which I think is, you know, possibility, when I was talking about heroin users and various users living, was it possible for them to live normal lives? And you said, well, kind of, maybe, sort of, and that you'd had people around for 30 years. I think your ethanol garden idea is a very interesting idea as well. And if you tell our listeners a little bit about that, and then we'll discuss some of the other drugs in the last part of the show here.
Well, it's simply a expression of compassion, there but the grace of God go I, toward, in this case, public inebriates, the kind of mostly men who get drunk in public in the evening and night and kind of obtrude on the downtown scene in many cities and towns.
Well, let's take San Francisco, which you're familiar with.
Yeah.
How much of this is there in San Francisco, say, in your opinion or your estimation?
Oh, I'd say you could talk to the police department. I'd say there's probably 1,000 basically homeless public drunks on the sidewalk each night. And it's you know, it's obtrusive. We don't like seeing it, and it's uncomfortable and perhaps dangerous for them. What I see is, picture a beer garden, like a German beer garden, kind of an enclosed space.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit removed from downtown. You go there in the early evening, if you're a public inebriate, and you have to, you know, a certain number of police arrests for that that problem. But you have a card, and you're allowed to go in and purchase ethyl alcohol, basically very powerful vodka.
And dirt
for the actual price that it costs to create vodka. The actual cost of vodka is about 1 cent per shot, 1 or 2 cents per shot.
How many shots are in a bottle?
Oh, in a typical bottle, 15 per
So you're saying it costs 15 cents to make a bottle of vodka?
That's right, 15 cents for a bottle. So most inebriates would just need 15 cents. Okay, easy to get. So that's their cost. But they have to stay there all night, and there are cots in places, you know, cots and to be comfortable, and they can mix their powerful vodka with fruit juice of any sort. But they're there in the evening and night, and they have to check weapons, any kind of weapons at the door, but they're given musical instruments like spoons or harmonicas or ukuleles, simple musical instruments, so they can strum and play for one another in this protected environment. And in the morning, they have a choice to leave, either just go out the door, the south door, saying, in effect, I'm just going to go back to my ordinary life, or they can go out through the east door, which is a recovery door, which is the door which essentially goes toward the morning sun, that says, I'm going to renounce this life. I'm going to become sober. I'm tired of this life. And that takes them right into a kind of 12-step or Alcoholics Anonymous situation, where they would essentially start with the very best way to become a recovered alcoholic, which is 12-step. Support from people like yourself.
Well, you know, John, I actually heard that AA has the highest highest recovery rate of any program going, something like 25%.
Yeah, which is good. I mean, that's 25% per attempt. But you try again and again, and pretty soon you may fail many times, but pretty soon you don't fail.
Well,
stay sober.
I went to the Alcoholism Center for Women. I actually had a blackout once from drinking too much.
Wow.
And I read that if you had a blackout, that meant you're an alcoholic. So
it's one of the indications.
So I checked into the Alcoholism Center for Women. I was supposed to be there for 14 days. I could only take 7 because there was so much cake, so much cigarette smoking, and so much starch that it made me actually ill.
Yeah.
And I think I would be what you would have called a periodic drunk or something. You know,
yeah.
Like an ongoing practice of mine, but the time that I did it so royally that I just thought I should do something.
Yeah, you're probably more like the majority, which is that once in a while we binge or we have too much.
Yeah, but, well, it's interesting because I decided to go after whatever was making me do that psychologically.
Well, exactly.
I have zero problem with alcohol.
That's the path of most of us. We have a few bad experiences. We go after what the source of it is, and we don't do it anymore. I think the alcoholic has a kind of he bargains or she bargains with the future.
Well, I don't even think it's just that. I don't know if you've ever had a problem with alcohol, but it used to feel like the inside of my mouth was pulling for a drink. Do you know what I'm talking about? It was a pulling. It was like a physical sensation that made me just want to pour alcohol in.
Yeah,
I don't have that physical sensation anymore. Whatever the psychology is that I went through, I actually invented an emotional clearing process. If people are interested, you can go to drvalerie.com, and doctor is all spelled out. I can actually remove emotional charges from the past, either whether this lifetime or any other. And by going through that program and other related programs and creating my own psychology, that pull has been gone for years. But it was a physical pull that made me want to pour in alcohol to make the pull stop. It wasn't even a regular pain. I'd be upset. I noticed it would be most happen if I was upset about a relationship.
Uh-huh.
And it would be a physiological thing that would occur.
You were adjusting your attitude, but
yeah.
In very, very specifically.
But a very specific pull, whatever the pull was. I mean, there was other times that I would cry or be upset, and there was no pull. But if there was a pull there, I was drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And it would happen 2 or 3 times a year. But when I looked at the solution, which, by the way, works for a lot of people, I just didn't want the macaroni and cheese. I didn't want the Jell-O. I didn't want the smoke, and they were always giving cakes and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that, and it was just like, oh, I can't do this. There's got to be another way, and fortunately, there was for me, and I appreciate it. But
yeah,
I'm also somebody that used a lot of ecstasy in the past, and I'm very grateful to it, to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Ecstasy saved my life. I came from a very dark background. And I had a very distorted view of the world. And for our listeners who don't know what ecstasy is, it's MDMA, which is joy minus one molecule.
Methylene dioxide methamphetamine, yes.
Say it one more time. I like the way that sounded.
Methylene dioxide methamphetamine.
See how good he is? When I got introduced to ecstasy, I actually got introduced to it on a very spiritual level by actually a man who was a Jesuit priest, interestingly enough. And he made us do all the research and gave us papers, and you know, we did these sacred conversations and all that, and I have to say, it really worked for me. I got a chance to actually interact with people without being so terrified and distorted, because they used it in group therapy at that time in Denmark and also in the psychiatric hospitals there. And they also, it was legal in the U.S. when we were using it. And then I guess something happened in Texas or something like that, and then it turned into the big bad drug. But the reality of the situation is that if there was a place that people could go and have it managed so that they could have these experiences, it's actually, I would call it actually a kind of truth serum.
Actually, yes. Yeah, your own truth.
Yeah, your own truth. It was like, I was always afraid. I had a member of my family that used to, like, sacrifice human beings and stuff. And so you can imagine that I was a little nervous about being around him. Go ahead.
I think what you had was what William James 100 years ago would have called one of the varieties of religious experience. Religious in the sense, simply the higher values.
Totally, totally.
Things beyond our own narrow lives.
I did something very funny, though. This was after it was illegal, but I did it anyway. So it was in 1988, I think. And I decided that I was going to take a half a tab of ecstasy every day for a week to see how my life was different, which on a half a tab is very easy to function. If you've ever seen anybody going around, dear listener, who's got their jaws locked and their eyes are fluttering a bit, they're doing ecstasy, usually. On a half tab, you're not having that kind of reaction, but you're also not having the hesitation of your program fears. So my life transformed in that week. People saw me differently. I spoke to them differently. I behaved differently, and I found out that I could get different results with different behavior, and that was really important because before that, John, the world was the way I said it was, and it wasn't a very nice world.
You broke out of fixed patterns, out of ruts.
Yes. And I did it in that 1 week on these half tabs. Now, I would love to see something in the U.S. that was sanctioned where, to this day, I would give my eye teeth to actually do something like that supervised with a group of people because I know the difference it can make.
Exactly. It's almost a can't-miss situation. There's so much good that can come out of that. It's hard to advocate for it because we're such an anti-drug society.
Except we're not. We smoke and drink like troopers.
Yeah. Yeah, but a hypocritical anti-drugs.
Yeah, there you go. That now it fits.
Yeah, the ones that have that got their cartels established first, the coffee, the cigarettes, the wine, the beer, they're thriving. But the ones who came a little late, like the ecstasy and the marijuana, nope, no chance for you.
Do you think that that's why marijuana is not legal is because of the liquor cartels and stuff?
Largely, but it's also 70 years ago, it was connected with Mexicans, so the Mexican workers would use. So it got a nasty reputation that way simply for some class prejudice. But also, when you had Harry Anslinger and J. Edgar Hoover in charge of the nation's drug use policies, they just chose to go after marijuana.
I haven't heard this Harry's name before. What was his name again?
Harry Anslinger was the original. He was the first drug czar, in effect, back in the 20s and 30s. Very much like J. Edgar Hoover, a kind of pinched, tight kind of person, very much a classist and racist.
But don't you think maybe part of that was because he was gay, not because of anything else?
Could be.
Because, you know, it would be very hard for a gay guy to be in such a macho setting as the FBI, you know?
Yes, and J. Edgar Hoover, they can be the nastiest of all because they're displacing their own personality on somebody else, and in effect pushing away the shadow, the hated side of themselves into an exterior victim.
Which makes me think of Anita Bryant.
Yes.
Do you remember that whole conversation?
Oh, my God. Oh,
our
my God.
Orange juice queen, who was liked women.
Uh-huh.
You know, I used to do T-shirts, okay? One of the T-shirts I made was Eat a Fruit for Anita.
Yeah.
And by the way,
I never heard that.
It made me very popular in the gay community. Because guys were getting Marys in the shirt and things like that. But I was very much the feminist, you know, and I was doing the feminist movement, and I was, you know, arguing with my husband about things and making T-shirts. And that T-shirt actually made me quite famous.
Uh-huh. I never did see it. But in a way, we're blessed by our enemies. We have we have choice enemies that are so, that almost make the case for us.
Say more.
Yeah, well, it's like you get these Haggard, the preacher who was so anti-gay, but he turns out to he likes to make it with the male prostitute, and you know, one after another of these instances of hypocrisy exposed on the part of our most fervent enemies.
Well, did you do? Have you done any research on this at all? I'm kind of interested in it because when I was doing my psychology thing there and getting my MFCC license, one of the things that we were being educated in was the fact that gayness, I guess, what we're calling gayness, occurs in about 80% of the population in some form or another, such as bonding.
Yeah, you know, same sex. The animal world as well, of course.
Yeah, exactly. I think snow geese, as I recall, it was like snow geese or something like that, or 14%.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't porpoises or something too?
Yeah. Oh, a great, great number of animal species, yes.
So a lot of the stuff, it seems to me that we're fighting a lot of shadows all the way from marijuana to gayness to caffeine to sugar. It's like it all is kind of like merged together into something that's supposed to be bad.
Yeah,
and yet it's all intertwined, you know?
How
do we pull it apart?
Well, Freud had the answer 100 years ago. He parsed out what was actually meant by Shakespeare's, I think, methinks the lady doth protest too much.
Yes.
So it's our most fervent, you know, those who are most fervently against something, look at their psychology. What they're doing is projecting their own hidden side, their own feared impulses, onto other people.
Have you seen W?
No, I'd like to.
Well, I was kind of disappointed in it, but it's getting very good reviews, but I thought it was very interesting in that because I always said that our current president was acting like look. Now, have you had that observation?
Acting
did that
like
ever
what?
Cross your mind?
Acting like what? Like a
dry drunk.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, of course. He has that to deal with in his life. And I have to say, recovering alcoholics, there's something not quite full about them in the way that I can relate to.
Yeah, until they're complete.
Yeah, they're not complete because wine is a gift from God. It's God's proof that he does love us. She does love us because she created a wine.
See, I love the fact that I have... Oh, a winemaker on the show. You have no idea. It's very sweet. I'll introduce you to Boyd Willett, who actually makes a dripless wine glass.
Oh.
He's quite a guy. He actually had put together the original Day Runner.
Oh, my goodness.
And he's been very successful in many areas, but one of his is his wine glass. I'm going to have definitely put the two of you together.
Mm.
That'd be total fun. But what I'm thinking about here is how we... The righteous person who will be against marijuana will weigh 300 pounds and be overweight because they've been drinking a lot of caffeine and eating a lot of sugars and things like that. And there's just I wanted this program partially so that we could start to pull things apart and see that there's value in places that we think that we aren't, and that we're judgmental in places that we think we're perfect, and somehow like start to separate this mess. Because until we do, we're going to be looking around opinionating all over the place.
Yeah, it's the Puritan theme in America, which is much stronger than in Europe. We just we're not comfortable with pleasure for its own sake.
If what do you pleasure, suggest?
Well, I think we need to retrain ourselves from the time we're children to be franker, more honest about what pleasure is. And show by example to our children that we grown-ups, we also can enjoy life. We can play. We can laugh. And not be so serious and puritanical.
We're going to have to start with the adults.
Yes, I think
because
so.
Because children get suppressed before they have a strength to hold an opinion.
Given the right examples, the kids will be fine. But with my kids, I am joyful and share my joys and honest that I'm not that adulthood is not all serious. It does have pleasure. It does have laughter and joy. In fact, that laughter is perhaps the greatest medicine of all, as the old saying goes.
So right now in California, I actually met the man in San Francisco. I was up there, and I was driving by in a car. I can't remember who I was. And he said, oh, there's the man that made medical marijuana legal in San Francisco. And I said, I have to meet him. And I jumped out of the car and met him. Do you remember his name?
Could it be Dennis Perrone?
Yes, that's the one.
Yeah.
So he was walking the streets with his dog. And I said, because this, to me, if I have a client and they're stressed out and they say, I'm going to be going home and having some marijuana and relax, I'm not going to criticize them at all.
Of course not.
Okay. So yeah, what do we do to get this in the conversation? Actually, I live fairly near Venice Beach, and I've seen people actually smoke marijuana in the presence of the police down there.
Mm-hmm.
But what do we do to get these things loosened up? So that America does not have to be, so that 1 million hours in prison, I think it's over 1 million, John.
1 million people, yeah.
People are in prison for doing time for, and that we're complaining that the prison system is overcrowded and these people are being ruined.
Here's my suggestion. There's at least 5 million marijuana smokers in California. A delegation of us should go to the Sacramento and in front of the governor and the legislature, shout out in unison, Governor, tax us. Legislature, raise our taxes. We want to be taxes. We want to be part of a legal system where if you just let our drug be used and enjoyed, tax it. You know, 30 cents per marijuana cigarette or whatever whatever.
Totally. I think it's a good thing.
$1 billion a year.
Yeah, how much? More than
that. $1 billion a year from California marijuana.
Oh, from California. I was thinking in terms of the U.S.
Marijuana smokers alone. That's, figure 5 million smokers, maybe $200 a year from the amount that we smoke.
Do you think
we're taxed on our vodka. Look at vodka, which is a penny a shot to make, but because of taxation and other, profit, we gladly pay $3 for a shot of vodka in our, whatever we have, vodka. Tonic, vodka, whatever.
Right.
And the premium vodkas, which is merely vodka, this pours five times through a filter, is $10 a shot.
You mean if you took ordinary vodka and then you refiltered it a few times, you'd have premium?
Yeah, use your Brita filter. You should get in your Brita filter and pour pop-off vodka, that's $6 $6 a fifth. Pour it through five times. And see if anybody can tell the difference between that and Grey Goose.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Now, that is pretty terrific, actually. So I hope everybody out there is listening.
Oh, yeah. Save some money. But, we're willing to pay. The point is we pay gladly for these cheerful wine and vodka. So likewise, we should pay cheerfully the tax for the marijuana. Tax us, Governor, and then let everybody smoke openly.
They had oxygen bars.
Yeah.
Now, Woody Harrelson had one here in Hollywood. I went to it, but it happened to be closed the day I went, and then it didn't seem to do much after that. I actually was in Las Vegas, and I actually went to an oxygen bar there. That made me feel terrific.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that maybe we could have you been to Amsterdam?
I have.
So I'm going to assume that you went to the coffee shops?
I didn't go in, but I observed them and their prices and the how comfortable they seem.
Okay, so I went in, because I'm a goer into the coffee shop.
Uh-huh.
I had heard that hashish was in there, in Europe, okay? And I had hashish once when I was younger. And I understood that they had it in places called coffee shops.
Yes.
So I
went into powerful stuff, yeah.
I went into the coffee shop. And I said, you know, I just wanted to find out how this worked and blah, 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 blah. And they showed me a menu, right?
Huh?
And the menu had like 10 different kinds of hashish that you could have. And then the guy told me all the different qualities and stuff like that. And I said, well, I've got a lot of stuff I want to write. What would you recommend? And he pointed to brown sugar, I think it was called. And I said, just too bad. And he said, no, we have pipes here so that you can use the pipe and you can try it.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. I smoked some hashish there. I went back to the hotel room, and I wrote like I have never written in my life. I have no idea. What is hashish?
It's marijuana that's simply been purified. But that's where I would say I would discourage. If you like marijuana, avoid the strong stuff or have just one or two tokes. You really got to watch it because too much makes you soporific.
That means like laid out?
Yeah, laid out.
Yeah, well, I just had a little pipe of it. I went back to the hotel, and I wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote, and then I came home.
Yeah.
But the reality is that I imagine, why couldn't we have something like that in the U.S.?
Sure. We could. Controlled, regulated, taxed. But always discouraging, folks, just one toke is going to be plenty, or two tokes.
Oh,
this
totally.
Yeah.
That's all you need.
Yeah,
and they give you, like, this little piece of it that looks like, I don't even know, like a crumb or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, have this little crumb, and then you put it in a pipe, and that's that.
Yeah, that's
but,
good.
You know, if that kind of thing was here, I think, now mind you, this was a few years back, John, but I think that crumb cost about $3.
Uh-huh.
That was it.
Yep.
How much do people, I was over at P.F. Chang's the other night, a very nice restaurant and bar and stuff like that, and I was watching people sitting at the bar having like, you know, two or three martinis. Tab
uh-huh.
on those was right around $25.
Right.
You know?
Uh-huh.
So what are we looking at here? We're looking at that we have some kind of illusions about what's fine and what isn't.
Mm-hmm. The whole problem.
Is there something in your background? Or are we picking up somebody else's noise?
Oh, I'm just walking in. It's lunchtime.
Well, good. You're going to be off the air soon. Where are you going for lunch?
Place called the Educated Palate here in San Francisco.
Ooh, it's making my mouth water.
Part of the
we've been
college.
On the air with John Neumeier and his book, Mother of All Gateway Drugs. Hope you found this an interesting conversation and really enjoyed being with you. And
yeah.
Join us again next week. We want to thank you, and this program has been brought to you by the Golden Hearts Foundation in association with Kirkgaard Media, our radio partners, ConingCompany.com, Monavi, Max GXL, Dr. James Murphy in Memoriam, Nathan Jett, Rich Kepler, and Jeff Spinard, and the team at Voice America, and to Ben Migan for our theme music, Almost Ordinary People. Next week, invite a friend to listen. And hey, you can hear us. We're in the restaurant. Remember, city is courteous. Thank you.
All right.
With extraordinary plans, almost all.